Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, and good afternoon to all our listeners in Australia, and good day to people who are about to get up in the morning.
You're buttering up all our friends in Australia, because that's where we're going next.
Buttering up the people in Europe. And
we have someone on the line as our guest for this segment who has a fascinating and very complicated background. It's Greg Patton, and we are really planning on discussing with him his new book, although his previous books. The new one is called A Baker's Odyssey, Celebrating Time-Honored Recipes from America's Rich Immigrant Heritage. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, you have such a fascinating background. It says here you were born in Hong Kong. You spent your early childhood in Shanghai. Then you immigrated to the United States with your family at 11. Then you got a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley and became a full professor of zoology at the University of Montana before learning to cook.
No. I learned how to cook way, way before that.
Okay. I see.
I was cooking from the age of 11.
And then you
Now, why did you start to cook at age 11? What was the fascination?
It's very interesting. When we arrived in San Francisco, television was just a very new medium. And my dad really wanted to buy a television set because he liked to watch boxing.
Friday night boxing.
Uh-huh. And so he bought the TV set, and of course we started watching everything, you know, that came on. But one of the things that really grabbed my attention was a local cooking show in San Francisco that was live. I just got fascinated by the whole process. Now part of it must have come from the fact that we lived with my mom's mom, my granny, for about 7 years in Shanghai during the first 7-8 years of my life. And she did all the cooking, and I was fascinated just by watching her in our one-room apartment, so that when I could actually see somebody demonstrate it in front of me in my own home, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away from my granny, I found it really fascinating. Yeah. And so I decided I wanted to try and cook. The first thing that I made was baking powder biscuits, and I got the recipe from the brand-new Betty Crocker cookbook that had been published in 1950 for the first time.
Which, they just re-released one, by the way. They just re-released Betty Crocker in a deluxe edition. I just got it in the mail.
Well, so, I'm wondering, is this the original book that's been re-released?
I don't know. It's all wrapped in plastic wrap. I haven't opened it yet.
You better unwrap it.
I have the original one that has the red and white checkered cover.
Yes,
is that the one?
Yes.
Yeah, that was my mother's. I have that. Yeah.
It's an amazing book.
Well, I haven't looked at it for years, but I have it. Now, Greg, you also have a background. Your father was Russian or your mother was Russian?
Father Russian, mother Iraq.
Iraq. And why were you in Shanghai?
They just met there. Shanghai was, you know, this very, very cosmopolitan place at the time. It's becoming very cosmopolitan.
It is.
It's going back to what it used to be like in pre-communist China, I guess.
Yes, exactly. My dad's family came from Russia. They left basically to escape the Russian Revolution. And my mom came to Shanghai because my granny had been widowed at a relatively young age and needed support. And so my mom's older brother was living in Shanghai, and so he sent for them.
Well, what an interesting background.
That's how my mom wound up in Shanghai, and then she met my dad at work. They got married very soon after they had met, I think, like within a couple of months.
Oh, wonderful.
They were growing up in Shanghai, not realizing it was a kind of an unusual place to grow up because it was, after all, it was where you grew up.
Yeah, it was my home.
Yeah, so you didn't have any questions about why am I living in this rather exotic place?
No, it wasn't. We were expecting that we would be living in China for, you know, all of our lives, basically.
Yeah, I mean, do you speak Chinese?
I do not. I knew enough as a child. I call it street Chinese.
Okay.
So I could get along, and I could negotiate, you know, with the pedicab drivers, you know, a fare to take me from point A to point B.
Uh-huh.
But even my Chinese friends spoke English, and Just pretty much everybody that I had associated with spoke English, so there was no need for me to actually learn the language. I understood a lot of it, but I didn't really speak it.
Now, you won a James Beard Award with your first, is it your first book?
It was my first book, but it was my last, you know, previous book to A Baker's Odyssey.
Okay, it's what is called, which?
Baking in America.
Baking in America. And it was Best of the Best by Food and Wine magazine as well. And I guess in the process of doing American baking, you would have figured out about all this immigrant baking.
Yeah, it was. A Baker's Odyssey is kind of the flip side of Baking in America, because Americans just love new things. We love to just do riffs on just about anything, and cooking is certainly something that we love to, you know, experiment with and do in innovative ways. And in Baking in America, I kind of told the history of America through baking, looking at, you know, the European recipes that came here and then how Americans, you know, took off and developed new twists on all of those things. And with A Baker's Odyssey, it was just the opposite. I wanted to meet immigrants who maintain tradition and keep baking things the way they learned in the countries that they came from.
And you went into their kitchens.
That's how they kept connected.
But you went back, you actually went into their kitchens to watch them, huh?
I did. I went to their homes and then actually worked with them. And one of the things I found, Anne, was that as soon as you start working with someone in the kitchen and you're handling ingredients and you're asking questions about, you know, how they learned and what's, why is this recipe important to them and all that, they really open up when you're actually in there working with them as opposed to, say, you know, interviewing them across a table.
Uh-huh.
I think actually cooking with someone becomes it's much more intimate and they're much more willing to share.
Now, you have, I think, is it 30 diverse cultures represented?
Yeah, I think there are 32 nationalities.
Right.
In there.
And you do both savory and sweet.
Yes.
And you have Eastern European, you have like arugula, you have sweet Irish soda bread, Chinese style. It goes everywhere.
It goes everywhere.
Portuguese, empanada.
Uh-huh.
Empadas.
Empadas, Portuguese, Mexican.
Is empanadas, yeah.
The empada is... it's a Portuguese name for something like an empanada. It's a pastry, and in this particular case, it's got a tuna and olive filling. But you can make an empada with just about anything. It can be savory or sweet.
Uh-huh. Of course, they were colonists everywhere. I mean, they seafaring, and they were in Brazil, too, so you would have picked up the empanada. Yeah, okay, and it comes with a DVD. Peter wants to ask you about the DVD.
Well, okay, Peter.
We actually talked, listeners, I'm not actually surprising Greg, because we talked about this before we went on the air, but I said, did he think this was a new trend to include a DVD of how to make some of the recipes that's actually inside the back cover? And I said, now we'll have to have DVD players in the kitchen, won't we? And Greg, what was your answer there?
Well, I said you all you really needed was your laptop computer and you can you know, put the DVD into that, and then you were concerned about
let's get a little hot fat and a little flour and a little bit of salt and pepper all over our laptop, and it'll taste good.
It won't work
very well, but it'll sure taste good.
Now, my whole idea for putting the DVD in, actually, it was not something I planned on originally when I first started working on the book. It was about after I was about 2 years into the process, and I had learned how to make, you know, Bavarian pretzels, and I had learned how to make strudel, and I thought, you know, I can write in words how to do this. I said, but it's far more reassuring if people can just see how it's done. Because they're not complicated things. It's just when you write about them, they sound complicated, but they're not. And so that if you're going to see how somebody is going to stretch strudel dough, I think it's a lot more valuable than just, you know, looking at a bunch of words. And I'm hoping that this will be a new trend. It would be wonderful if one could have, you know, a video of every single recipe, but then, of course, that would be several, you know, DVD volumes.
Well,
so
yeah,
I just decided
tricky.
To put in 10 different things.
Yeah, I mean, it was tricky because I was working on a cookbook with a chef, and he had something where he used that, the dough that looks like shredded wheat, the green stuff?
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I finally gave up and just said, follow directions on the package. Because it was just too hard to explain. Yeah.
And I agree with that. I think that, you know, it's too hard to explain, so, you know, have a picture.
How did you figure out how many people you're going to talk to and who to, I mean, here's one I never heard of, Chin Chin.
Chin Chin is Nigerian.
Yeah, it says Nigerian nuggets. I mean, who would have thought?
Yeah, they're delicious. They're wonderful and a very simple recipe. But, you know, a lot of these things, you know, that are individually shaped took time to make. But as it was explained to me by so many of the women that I worked with, that this is not a solitary activity. That
right.
Women would get together and they would make a lot of one or two or more things. But because there were so many bodies involved, the time just went and they were able to turn out huge amounts of stuff.
And it was a networking and social activity, a community.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it's all part of, you know, being social and interacting and gossiping and catching up on family, and they're preparing their foods, but the food is what brought them all together and united them in this wonderful emotional bond, this emotional place.
Oh,
and
these photographs are great.
That was one of the things that I discovered when I was working, you know, through the book.
And meeting all these people. Did you have to travel everywhere, or you have all these people in Montana?
Well, yeah, I had a tremendous number from Montana. There were, I think, 18 people in the book.
Wow.
18 out of the 65 are pretty much right in my neighborhood, which made me think, when I say neighborhood, I mean in the city, which made me think that, you know, we really are a nation of immigrants, because I think you could probably go to just about any state and any fairly large city in any state and find many, many dozen nationalities that would be willing to contribute to a book like this.
Hey, you really totally captured my heart on, I can't see what the page number is, but here's something that my family made. It was a ritual. Cucidade.
Oh, cucidade?
We called it cucidade. Remember, we were Sicilians.
Yeah, right.
And it was a two-day operation.
Uh-huh.
You know, you had to grind all these sticky dates and figs and stuff, dry figs. But the thing that's good about this book is the only recipe we had was from my Aunt Clara. And it would not make anything less than 12 dozen of these things.
Yeah.
And if you tried having the recipe or cutting it down in any way, nothing turned out right.
But as a result...
That was really part of my job was, you know, after I would get home, I would say, well, nobody's going to make 12 dozen or 8 dozen.
Aunt Clara did.
Well, yeah, you see, but your Aunt Clara grew up doing it.
Yes, I know. But even with my mother, I mean, it was a whole family thing to do these things. Every Christmas we did them.
Yes, it's a wonderful time for people to get together.
Right up above this is rabbit. It's Anzac cookies, which is another since we lived in Australia. I mean, all our favorites are in this book. This is just a revelation.
Well, you know,
Greg,
I never did like Lamingtons very much.
Oh, they're in here too.
Yeah, I know that. I know they're in there.
God! Lamingtons are one of the best things in the book.
Yeah, I really never caught on to
Pavlova's
pie and Lamingtons. I just never.
What I say about Lamingtons, and I think it's perfectly true, is that Lamingtons are to Australians what the chocolate cupcake is to Americans.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I think even more fundamental, I think, and that's what makes it so weird, because I don't think they taste all that good.
Oh, well, then you probably didn't have a good Lamington.
Yeah, maybe that's what
and do me a favor and make Peter some Lamingtons.
Yeah, I'm just reading it says, Lamingtons are to Australian what chocolate cupcakes are to American. They're squares of yellow butter cake dipped in a chocolate sauce and coated with unsweetened coconut. Oh, God, it sounds just dreadful.
But you know what else you can do? What else you can do instead of the coconut, or in addition to the coconut, make some Lamingtons coated with a coconut, and then you can take some finely ground macadamia nuts and then dip some of them into that.
Well, that's good, because they're growing those in Australia now. We're going to be visiting.
I'm going to be really jingoistic here and say that I really am shocked that there's only one recipe from my native land, which is a Cornish pasty. it seems to me that we must have a somewhat larger contribution to the world of baking than that.
You got spotted dick.
It's not in there.
Wait a second, before we start challenging each other to a duel. Remember, there are three Welsh recipes in there.
I know that's not English, it's Welsh, but
there are three Welsh recipes, and there are a couple of Irish recipes in there. So, I mean, the British Isles are well represented.
You're just getting into more and more trouble putting in recipes from these peripheral conquered nations.
Greg, this has been so much fun talking to you. I wish you could come visit. We could bake together.
Well, it's likely that, you know, my younger son lives in Philadelphia.
Well, we were just there, and we lived there for a long time too.
And I mean, Pittsburgh isn't all that close to Philadelphia.
No, it's not even vaguely close.
But how about if I got in touch with you the next time I come out, you know, and then we see what we can do.
Well, that's great. We move around a lot, so
that would be a whole lot of fun. Anyway,
that would be great.
The book is called
A Baker's Odyssey.
And it's by Greg.
Patent, who's freezing his buttons off in Missoula. Yeah.
and then you can learn all about the wonders of Lamingtons.
And I think I'll send you Aunt Clara's recipe for cucciatada.
Oh, I would love it. Can you do that?
Sure.
Okay. I'll drop you an email note just to remind you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Greg, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you.
Have a warm winter in Missoula, Montana.
Thank you so much.
And now it's time to take a break.
Okay.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And remember to email us your thoughts on the menu at onthemenuradio.com. And also, you probably want to send comments on this exciting new segment that we're doing here with Roland Mesnier, who served as pastry chef of the White House for 26 years and has authored a book called All the President's Pastries.
Yes. So we're going to do pastry and politics at the same time. That's a very appropriate thing to do at this particular season of the year, I guess. So before we sign off, Roland, we must get your suggestions as to who you think will be the next resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
The next leaders of the world.
And perhaps we'll do the story of how they can call you back, because I'm sure Laura Bush will leave a good word for whoever it is. So if the pastry chef isn't working out, you've been back twice, so I'm sure he'd be ready to go back again.
Well, let's start with this incredible journey you made as from a poor country boy in France, one of nine children, to the supreme pastry chef of the USA in the White House kitchen. How did this happen?
Well,
it's a dream, right?
You know, it really came to me. What people have to realize, I did not seek the job at the White House. The White House seek me. And so they asked me if I would be interested to have this position, which I was not really excited at the time, because I thought that was not a job for me. I didn't think I was qualified for that job. And beside that, I had a very great job at the time. I was the executive pastry chef at the Homestead Hotel.
Which is a wonderful hotel.
Wonderful hotel in Hot Spring, Virginia, a place I recommend for people who want to unwind, vacation. Wine and Dine is a great place for that.
That's great.
And I was truly happy down there. I'd find the place where I was going to perform my profession for the rest of my life, really.
No, we've been there for a visit. In fact, there's a little family secret which I'll let out on the air, listeners. Mrs. Haig has spent her entire life with me trying to get me on a horse. And when we were visited Hot Springs, the Homestead Resort in Hot Springs, she finally got her wish to come true.
Yes.
Because there were no other activities that I could do instead.
That would be the place to do that. You know?
And my horse was the one that wanted the grass that was off to the side. So I felt on the entire ride, like, as if I was going to go over the horse's head and land on the ground.
So,
I just read the story of how you got the job at the White House.
Yes.
And I read it just a little bit differently. You sort of heard a rumor that this was going on.
Yes.
But you thought that you possibly really weren't well qualified, so you were sort of reluctant to go.
Yes, because I didn't think they would pick up somebody from a hotel that is in the middle of nowhere when they can pick up somebody from New York, Washington, you know, Chicago, Boston, from big city like that. So I really had, I wasn't dreaming at all. And Barack, as a matter of fact, it happened so fast that it made my head spin.
Yeah, I read that part where you said you went down for your interview and you really wanted to leave because you wanted to go home.
That's it.
Presumably to escape all the terrible traffic coming out of the District of Columbia in that direction.
Yes.
But they said, please hang on because Mrs. Carter would like to talk to you.
Yes.
And I think you complete the story by saying that you found out that you were the only pastry chef candidate that you actually talked to.
Exactly. There's been many candidates who came to the White House, but I was the first candidate that Mrs. Carter wanted to talk to, yes.
Did you ever find out why?
No, I have no idea. Well, I think I know by knowing how the White House worked, because most of the candidates had been interviewed previously by Mrs. Carter's social secretary. And she would relate to Mrs. Carter what she thought of the candidate. And I believe probably what she related to the First Lady was not too positive. So I think she thought that there was no necessary to use any of her time to meet anybody. At the time, I thought. That would be the only explanation that I would guess.
Well,
again, it's a guess of my part.
Now, your book is filled with reminiscences and also some really wonderful photos. I'm looking at this one that I'm not sure I understand, in California with a pink Cadillac and private chauffeur.
Yes, that was really something, because when I went to Oakland, California, when I was preparing for my visit there, I was there to make the picture in the studio for my first book. It's called Dessert University.
Oh, yes.
It's a pastry book that was published in 2004. By the way, it's a wonderful book for people who want great recipe and recipe that work for a change.
Yeah, right.
And
we're going to come back and talk about that one.
Yes. And anyway, when I was there, before I arrived, the lady of the studio said to me, well, you know, my studio is located in an area where it's very dangerous. You know, there's a lot of crime, and after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, even the taxi cab don't want to come there. So I said, well, can you find me someone who would drive me from my hotel to your studio? I pay him whatever every day, you know, pick up in the morning and bring back me in the evening. So she did just that. So when I arrived over there, I said, well, do you have a car for me? She said, yes. I did find you a driver. I did find you a car, but there's only one catch. It's a big, a stretch pink limousine. I said, oh, my God. So when I met the fellow, he was extremely nice, and he was picking me up and bringing back to my hotel every day for, $10 a day. So you could miss that, you know. That was really great. And on top of that, the people in my hotel, they thought by watching me leave every day, as a matter of fact, they called Hanzo every day in the morning. They'd be ready with their camera. They thought I was some kind of a star.
And well, where you are.
You know, they were taking pictures of me, and they would ask me, who are you? What are you doing here? And I refused to tell them. I never told them where I was and what I was doing in town.
Uh-huh. Now, the pink Cadillac is such an important part of your life. It's
Yes.
I mean, it's actually on the front cover of the book.
Well, it's the American dream. But I can't understand, as we were talking before, how it was to work under that kind of pressure. Every time there was a new administration, you had a new agenda to have to follow.
Yes.
How many different presidents did you work under?
5.
And who were they?
Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., President Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush.
Could you just riff through each of those with one peculiarity? You do relate the anecdotes in your book. But
yes,
just for our listeners,
yes,
let's start with the preferences of
President Carter.
Carters, yes.
Yeah, President Carter. The Carter family, again, Mrs. Carter was kind of very politically involved, so she had less of time to involve herself with the food. But nevertheless, contrary to what the press stated there, the Carter had some great dinner going on too and great food. And but when they ate among themselves, when they had dinner together or luncheon, the family, they had very simple food. They liked simple food like everybody else mm-hmm. Would like in their home. And what they were trying to do is they were watching also their diet a lot, and the Carter preferred when there was no guest to have no dessert but just have fresh fruit at the table, uh-huh. which is what we did.
That's good.
But President Carter loved a good chocolate cake. Mrs. Carter loved desserts that were very dainty and light.
And Amy?
And Amy loved her cookies. Amy was a cookie girl. As a matter of fact, she loved to bake her own cookies. That's why she would burn them most of the time.
Oh, that's funny.
Because she was busy roller skating around the house after she put them in the oven.
Great. Now, moving on.
And then after we moved to President Reagan, Mrs. Reagan was truly, a great perfectionist. You know, the White House never looked better than under the Reagan administration.
But she looks like she never ate.
Oh, but she did. She ate three meals a day, and she had dessert with every meal.
Did she really?
Oh, yes. But desserts were very small, very dainty. And we put them through the calorie extractor, you know, before we give it to them.
You know, that was she's like a size zero.
But the style of dessert that I made for her was really very healthy, very good, and beautiful dessert. That's what the requirement that she wanted to have. Of course, President Reagan was craving for chocolate.
Oh, he liked chocolate.
And I had my orders not to give him chocolate. But you know, we took care of dear President Reagan when she'd be out of town. We gave him a big bowl of chocolate mousse for lunch. And I think he really, really enjoyed that, you know.
That's great.
And
the Bushes?
After we had President Bush and Mrs. Bush that came in. Mrs. Bush was never a demanding first lady. She, you know, believed in making things easy as possible. She was also very busy with the family, very involved. As you know, the Bush is a large family with the grandkids and the kids and everything. And then she also was looking over us so we would produce very healthy dessert for the family and mainly the children. And everybody had to show up at the table on time and eat together. There was not ordering staff to go eat somewhere else of some other part of the White House. Everybody else had to show up at the table and on time and dressed up accordingly. That was Mrs. Bush's requirement for the family. President Bush he ate all sort of different foods.
No broccoli.
that other president would not eat. Meaning, even strange food, he loved that, you know, like shad roe and oyster fixed different ways and so on. That under president wouldn't even go near that. So he was really, in that respect, a gourmet president.
Except he didn't, and just interjected, he didn't like broccoli.
That is correct. That was one of the few things. But hey, listen, he was the president of the United States.
If he doesn't have to eat broccoli, he doesn't have to. You're
exactly,
right.
Exactly. And then after that, of course, with President Clinton coming in, and the party during the Clinton exploded, the numbers exploded, they went absolutely crazy. That's when we were very, very busy all these years. And of course, President Clinton had allergy. Especially chocolate, yeah. Dairy product, and flour.
Well, he had gluten intolerance, did
yes.
he?
Yes.
Does he have celiac disease?
I don't know, but I only know of his allergy. And I did work very hard to be able to produce dessert under those orders.
Yeah, well, of course, this was tough at that time. Now it's getting a little easier. More people are producing things
yes.
that are gluten-free yes. and so forth.
But, you know, those years, I always knew looking at the president on television when he had been a very, very bad boy, when his eyes will be all puffed up and things like this, I knew he ate something he was not supposed to, like chocolate.
Okay, so you knew, but he would sneak around that, I guess.
Oh, yes, sometimes he would sneak around a big piece of chocolate cake when he was not supposed to. And he couldn't hide it, because the next day I would be watching TV and he would be there and say, uh-oh, he's been a very bad boy again.
I used to think he must be hungover. Okay. So what about the current incumbent?
And then the of course after that we had President George W. Bush that came in, and everything changed again in the White House this time. And Mrs. Laura Bush, First Lady Laura Bush, is also a perfectionist in my own mind. I know she likes the White House to be absolutely perfect for the guests and the decoration, the way she decorated the house and everything. And the food, the same. She likes very pretty food, beautiful food. And I believe she's very happy these days with their new executive chef, the lady executive chef that they have
all
now.
Right.
I think she's doing a fabulous job for them. And then, you know, the president also likes her food very much, but he likes a little bit heavier food than the first lady. And he likes to recognize the food that he eats on his plate. He hates when things are chopped up so fine so he can't see what he eats. He does not like that. And for dessert, he likes a good old piece of American cake and ice cream. Ice cream is a must with his dessert.
Oh. Well, now, 26 years is an incredible length of time to be in the same place. And there's an interesting story around this, because I understand you started out with 25 years and then you quit, presumably you retired.
Yes.
And an old friend of Anne's, Thaddeus Dubois, took over.
Yes.
And then that wasn't all that successful, so they said, would you come back?
Yes, well, I got a phone call asking me if I would mind coming back on my own ride whenever I could, and so on, to work on state dinner and things like this, mainly. And the big dinner that was coming up, and a lot of them was coming up at the time, they were going to have a big luncheon for China, a state dinner for Australia.
Oh, I see. So it was really important. The importance of the job was also being able to deal with all these great banquets, as well as just dealing with the first family.
Because, you know, all my life at the White House, I always design a dessert for the occasion. Never repeated the same dessert twice on that.
Wow.
And when a president or a prime minister or whatever would come to the White House, I would design a dessert specially for them for that time that would reflect either their countries or the many, many things. I would never reproduce what they do in their own country because, first of all, A, I could not have done it better than they do it in their own country, and B, they wanted to see something different, I'm sure, coming to the
right.
United States. But I would respect the flavor that they are used to and the type of food they're used to, but I would not use their recipe or their the way it would be done in their own country. It would be typically giving a twist that was a design for the particular day at the White House.
Now, what about Mrs. Thatcher? Did Mrs. Thatcher like dessert?
She loved dessert, too.
Okay, and what about Tony?
She was a great, great lady, as you know. I had a lot of respect for her, not only as a human being, but as a leader. I thought she did an extremely grand job. As you know, she was very good friend with President Reagan.
Right.
They got along very well together, and that helps when two leaders get along together. You know, that
sure.
makes the day much better.
Sure.
And I designed many desserts for her and for occasion, and always something that... that she would enjoy, and I was very successful doing that.
Now, what about Tony and Sherry Blair? Were they...
All the time the same. Great people. Tony Blair, as you know, was friendly with all the American president that he had to work with, and always very cheerful prime minister, and always trying to, as I used to work in England myself many years ago at the famous Savoy Hotel. And
right,
you know, the
right.
Savoy, we used to serve the Queen of England regularly every month, and other dignitary, English dignitary at the hotel. So I knew the kind of the English way without reproducing really English dessert, but I knew about which way to go to put
right.
something on the table that they would really appreciate.
We discovered that he liked to eat out a lot, because we were at one restaurant in London and they said that he used to, just around the corner from 10 Downing Street, and he used to pop in all the time, so he had perhaps more of an interest in food than many presidents have had. But listen, we're having time is absolutely flying by here. You did promise that you would answer one question for us as we close. There is nothing to do with food, but does have to do with the future incumbent of 1600 Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Avenue, who might even call you back to work. So what do you think?
Well, what I think right now, I think it's too early to call anybody. The race is still on. I think that the country needs a change. I think we need a profound change, because I think the politic as usual, people are very tired of it. I really think that we need fresh ideas and new direction. And I know this is how I'm going to vote. I don't know for whom yet, but I definitely will pick a candidate. You see, I don't vote Republican or Democrat. I vote whomever I think is going to be good for the country.
Okay, well, listen, let's get this on the program so that the new resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue knows that it's okay for him to call you to come back and cook. So if someone called, would you go back, Roland?
I don't know, because I'm kind of out of the loop these days. Mm-hmm. And I made a statement last time when I left the White House. I said, well, I hope I will never be called again, because otherwise I'm going to be known as the only human being that jumped the White House fence going out.
Roland, your book is just charming, and anybody can, it's on our website, so anybody can go to www.onthemenuradio.com, OTM bookshelf, and click on and order it direct off our website. We've only skimmed the surface of this. There's so many great stories and so many great world events that you witnessed, and you just have so much information. It's been a pleasure.
This book would inspire a lot of young people today that are whining that they can't make it in life because of this or because of that. My book show you totally differently, that if you work hard enough in life, you can make it anywhere, anytime, any place.
As you did.
Well, that's a wonderful thought with which to end this interview and to end the program for this week. Roland, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, many, many more fascinating stories in this book. It's a don't put down. You might read it from cover to cover, and you don't even have to like dessert to enjoy the stories.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter's going to have his spin in the spotlight today.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Because our next guest is actually Jim Ryan, who's CEO of Monarch Imports. And they import beer, and we're going to be, since we're in the year of the rat, we're going to be talking about...
What kind of beer to pair with rat?
Exactly. I've been seeing all these ads, actually, for Be Kind to the Rat Ear. Have you seen those? Hello,
yes.
Jim.
yes, I have. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so Peter's going to ask you all about this wondrous Chinese imported beer.
Well, it's really fascinating, because there's one very large brand of fully imported beer that I know about that comes into the United States. A lot of other foreign beers have gone to manufacturing in the U.S. Heineken has never done that, nor has the product you represent, but it comes a whole lot further, and beer's kind of heavy. So how do you make this work?
How about giving the name of it, you guys?
Yeah, well, I call it Qingdao. And
how is it pronounced,
Jim? Jim's
going to
pronounce it properly.
That is right. That's exactly the Qingdao beer, and we have been importing Qingdao, the Monarch Import Company, since 1978. The beer first arrived in the United States right after President Nixon had visited China in 1972. And what we try to project to our consumers and to our customers and our retailers is the authentic experience. So we have never, we never considered brewing it anywhere in North America or outside of China. Beer is a heavy product. It's all packaged in China. It travels, 8,000 miles to get here to the United States via on ocean containers. We distribute it through a network of our wholesalers that are in every single state here in the United States, and we're very proud of what we've been able to accomplish with the product. It's, you know, it's a great product, and certainly it's the number one Chinese beer here in the United States today.
It's the one everybody recognizes, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it even goes to the standard, it's probably the most recognized or is the most recognized branded consumer product that comes out of China today, even with the explosive growth that China has had. Everybody recognizes the name Qingdao beer.
Yeah, it's really funny. I used to like an Indian beer called Kingfisher. You probably know that.
Yes, I've heard that.
And then I was so disappointed one day to read that it's now manufactured in either Maine or Vermont, and it's really not the same thing. But in a nutshell, what is it that makes Qingdao so special? What is the uniqueness about its flavor? Is it ingredients that are different?
I think what makes it unique is the consumer may not think of China as, you know, a land of where, you know, great beer is produced or beer is produced in general. China is the number one producing country in the world today when it comes to beer. But when the Qingdao Brewery was founded, it was founded in 1903, and it was founded by German settlers. Now the Germans knew a little bit, know a little bit about beer, so very involved with the startup of that brewery, and over time it has, you know, there's a lot of from the technology, and our brewmasters that work at the Qingdao Brewery have been trained not only in Germany but around the world. We use imported products when it comes to the hops and it comes to the malt that we use in the product.
You don't produce those in China. You get them from someplace
else. Well, there is some product, but we'll use a blend of that. We do have some of the ingredients that are produced in China, but I think with the recipe and the formula that our brewmasters or the brewmasters of the Qingdao Brewery have come up with is something very special, and they've crafted it to we have two products here in the United States, and the original product, Qingdao Lager, is much more of a full flavored kind of a sweet bodied taste in the product that pairs well with certain kind of foods. And the Qingdao Pure Draft, which is a new product we brought in 2006, just introduced in 2006, that product is a little lighter tasting product that pairs well with different styles of food than the Qingdao Pure Lager. So we just want to give our consumers a choice and, you know, an experience of something that's authentic from
Looks Chinese. The colors, red and gold.
Yes.
Well, the label certainly. It's interesting. I mean, how to describe it? I mean, here's how I'd sort of describe it. I mean, it's very hoppy, but it's light bodied. I think is the way I would categorize it. And so if you took a classic European beer like Pilsner or Kal from the Czech Republic, that's got the same kind of hoppy flavor, but it's got a generally heavier beer flavor. So this is much lighter in would you say, Jim?
Yes. But it's got a slightly malty flavor, sweet taste. It's crisp and goes great with spicy food.
Okay, what do you eat?
Which makes a lot of sense.
You drink it with what, Chinese food and other foods?
The way that we started was, again, the distribution for Qingdao was, for a long period of time, was primarily in Chinese restaurants. So whether you were eating, whatever, Kung Pao chicken or orange peel beef or something that's, you know, very zesty and spicy in flavor, the Qingdao went excellent with. Now, as with in the restaurant business, as the tastes have expanded, now you have Pan-Asian style cooking that probably blends not only Chinese but Vietnamese and Qingdao has followed that. We've gained distribution in those kind of restaurants. We have looked for greater distribution in the off-premise, like grocery stores, and what we talk about in our business is out-of-department displays that we can build in a store. So if you walk into whatever a major market might be, or a major store in Pittsburgh or Cleveland or New York, where they have counters where there's fresh seafood or sushi or shrimp. We try to build displays of our product in those areas, so when that consumer is shopping, it's a great thing to pick up when you're buying, you know, your fresh meats and fresh food and fresh vegetables.
Huh. Now, you say that it's the equivalent of a wine, but it's only two variations on a theme, right?
Two variations relative to our product?
Yes.
Yes, yes. I mean, from a supplier standpoint, which we are here, you know, distributing to our we have 300-plus customers around the United States that we sell to, who they in turn then sell to, you know, the restaurants and the supermarkets. Our portfolio consists of those two products. I mean, there's a lot of beers out. There's probably 500-plus just imported beer brands that are available in the United States. It's been our, I guess call it business model that we have, and there's many more products available in China, but we wanted to pick two or three products that we could focus on and we could support and that we could build a story around. If we talk again in 5 years, we may have some additional brands from Qingdao in the marketplace.
So they do actually have other brands, other products?
Yes, they have other brands that are distributed throughout China.
Okay. Is that the most favorite thing that's consumed as an alcoholic beverage in China?
Relative to, yes.
Beer.
Beer is absolutely the number one alcoholic beverage product that is consumed.
They don't do wine.
They have some wine. I mean, they produce wine in China, and it's in its infancy stage, but I'm sure that's a segment that will grow over time, but beer is by far and away the number one alcoholic beverage.
And I've been reading about the start of growing grapes and making wine in China, but I think they're going to have a fairly steep learning curve. and there's a lot of competition around the world when it comes to beer. They've been doing it since, I think you said, 1903.
Yeah.
So they have some clue as to how to do that, and they had brewmasters to begin with who really knew what they were doing. I'm laughing to myself because it's really curious that Qingdao is made with classic beer ingredients imported into China. Anne probably doesn't know this, but the largest selling brand of packaged beer in the United States, otherwise known as Budweiser, is actually made with rice.
That's correct.
Which accounts for the fact, listeners, that he doesn't taste of anything, just in case you are wondering why.
That's very true. That's very true. I guess it's another example, especially today, of this global economy, this globalist society that we live in.
Well, do you send the containers back to China filled with American beer? Or?
No. Well, I'll tell you what. I take that back, Peter. I'm not sure that some of it doesn't go back, but there's so much product and material that is exported from the United States that goes back to China also because of the trade. I'm sure it's filled up with everything from consumer products to agricultural products, whatever. But we just worry from our standpoint, from our logistics model, we just worry about, and the brewery takes care of shipping the product. We take possession of it when it reaches U.S. shores.
Oh,
I see. But you know what I want to say? I won't get it right, but I want to say Gung Hai Fat Choi.
Gung Hai Fat Choi, very good.
which means?
Happy and prosperous New Year.
Yes.
Great. Well,
and
that
to you.
Yeah, happy
Qingdao.
And prosperous. Happy prosperous Year of the Rat to Monarch Importing. May sales of Qingdao soar.
Thank you very much.
Jim, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you so much for joining. Are you going to be in Beijing for the Olympics?
I certainly hope. I was over there right after the start of the new year, and I hope to be back there for the Summer Olympics.
Is the pollution as bad as they say it is?
Well, you know, when a country is growing the way that they have some pollution, but whatever they do, it's very interesting, and I've been traveling there since almost 20 years, and when they put their mind to change something or do something, they get it done. And I know the Olympics is China is going to be on the world stage, and I'm confident that it will be a successful Olympics.
Well, would you make a point of calling us and letting us know when you're ready to give the report?
I will. I will do that.
That would be great.
Once again, Jim, a happy year of the rat. Thank you so much for joining us, and now I think it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to email us. We love hearing from you. It's on the menu at onthemenuradio.com, and check out our website.
Yeah, there's all kinds of wonderful stuff that we keep on putting there whenever Peter has time from all the other activities associated with On the Menu, because we're such busy guys.
We're busy.
And we're coming back from break here as busy as ever. With a fascinating new guest. Now, it's going to sound a little bit like Johnny One Note, but there's more to this than meets the eye, listeners, I assure you, because we talked to Jason Kessler just a few minutes ago before we started this recording, and there's a lot more to the story of Holmato than you would think.
I thought I was going to do this introduction.
Oh, well, you can do it. Well, you can do the Holmato.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to do. Some say Holmato, some say Holmato. And what's next?
What is it Adam used to say? Stop singing, Mommy.
Stop singing, Mommy. That's right.
And listeners, now you know why. Before Anne became co-host of a radio program, she really wanted to be a jazz singer.
And you understand why that didn't go anywhere. But anyhow, as I said to Jason just before we came on air, this is a huge leap of faith for me, because I am broadcasting from Pittsburgh, home of the ketchup, Heinz.
Which pours, incidentally. There's a special light effect at one end of the stadium, which doesn't pour Holmato. It pours Heinz ketchup whenever the Steelers score any points.
But I fell in love with this product. It is a new ketchup, and it is, moreover, a healthy ketchup. And Jason, tell us why. Explain what this product is.
Holmato is an agave ketchup, an organic agave ketchup, and so what we
now that doesn't really explain it all that clearly. Do the agave bit? No, well, you'll get to the agave bit. Listeners, bear with us.
I'm coming with it.
Okay, great stuff.
We're 100% organic, which is our first benefit. The second is that we're sweetened with organic agave nectar. Now, agave nectar comes from the agave plant, which grows in the high desert of Mexico, and the magic of the agave nectar is that it is a low glycemic sweetener.
So people who are diabetic can use this with no problem, right?
Exactly. It's great for baking, cooking, sweetening teas or beverages.
Yeah, we've been getting cookbooks with that this is the new sweetener. This is the hot new sweetener.
But hold on a second here. I'm a little bit confused with the chemistry here, which is probably not all that surprising, I guess, because we talk about it as being high in fructose. Now, the enemy of all people who might be inclined towards being a little overweight, I understand, is called high fructose corn syrup. So how is fructose from agave different than fructose from corn syrup?
What high fructose corn syrup really is basically table sugar. When they highly process the corn into corn syrup, they get a highly concentrated fructose sweetener, and then it gets added back with some glucose, and they basically come up with almost like a table sugar sweetener.
Okay, so the fructose, the natural fructose, is a different animal altogether.
It is.
It's not. I mean, I think corn syrup's more like petroleum.
when you look at the facilities that make corn syrup, you start to get an idea of what's going on here. It's quite an elaborate operation.
Well, now you indicated that you really came at this whole product as a result of an involvement in health issues.
Correct.
I mean, I would say that that's a legitimate thing, because there is so much coming across our desk now about of people with various intolerances and allergies and so forth and medical problems. But the thing that I like about it is it tastes good.
Yeah, we I've got a lot of chef friends. My folks had a restaurant. Taste and the quality of ingredients has always been paramount in my life. And when we set out on this venture, we were committed to making it organic, and at the same time, not sacrificing any flavor or the taste experience. And so we spent a couple of years working on this recipe and the manufacturing process to get where we are. And that is one thing we are so proud of, is that when I start talking about it to people at demos and giving them an opportunity to taste it for the first time, I can see they're a bit hesitant when I start talking about how healthy and good for them it is. And then as soon as it goes into their mouth, the light in the eyes shines, because people really get it then. They're like, wow, this tastes good, and it's good for me.
I think there's I think it even gets to you before you get that, because when you open the bottle and pour it out, it even looks different.
Yes, you're right.
So you sort of get a clue that you're onto something that really might be kind of special here.
Well, and that's the other thing. We committed to packing our product in glass, because it's an inert substance that's been used for over 1,500 years, and we're not worried at all about the container for the ketchup. And so most people are used to squeeze bottles now, and that's another difference in the experience.
And the glass can be recycled?
Yes. And the infrastructure for recycling glass is much more robust, because we've been doing it for much longer.
And you have you've sort of locked your mother in the kitchen, apparently.
Weekend.
She's come up with these recipes.
She spends weekends in the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
She came up with the ketchup recipes. She had an incredible barbecue sauce recipe. Now one of the things that we're working on, really she's working on at this point, is to help us move beyond ketchup as a simple condiment. We're looking to include it as an ingredient. And so we are working on a lot of different recipes that can be done in a quick amount of time and maintain that high level of quality and taste.
Now, I mean, you're not going to get rich doing a one product, especially a condiment, are you?
No.
So what else is down the tubes here?
We've got
the pike, not the tubes. I mean pike.
We've got a couple of interesting things that she's working on right now. I'm not really sure where we're going to go with it. I found that with the ketchup, we started down a path and ended up doing almost a 90-degree turn coming up with the ketchup when we did. And so we've got a couple of feelers out there, a little bit of research in the kitchen going on, and I can't say for sure where it will lead at this moment. It's just kind of a fun process that we're allowing to unfold as it will.
I mean, do you have like a day job, or is this?
I'm all catch up all the time these days.
Funny.
But before that, you did something altogether different.
I was involved in a wellness center here in New York City, and I did essential oil treatments and taught yoga. And before that, I worked at the space program. I worked at NASA for about 8 years.
Oh, that's a good wellness program, working for NASA.
Reaching for the stars.
You know, everybody's so embracing the premium foods and also all the organics. I just read an article saying that farmers can't keep up with the demand for organics.
Yes. Yeah, it's true.
So what's going to happen?
I think it's going to cause more farmland to be converted into
farmland instead of houses, right?
It's a real challenge. I was just reading that in terms of organic meat, there are a lot of folks that are struggling with finding organic feed for the animals.
Right. So, but, you don't have to actually be certified organic. You can still be all natural. You can still be, you've read Michael Pollan's book.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe that's where people will kind of get smartened up instead of just a knee-jerk reaction to an identifying term.
Yeah,
they will understand where the animal comes from, where the produce comes from, and what goes into it.
I think that is what's going to happen. That's my sense of where we're headed, is that the definitions are going to become more clear, and the consumer is going to become more educated and demand more information. And I think that's great. I think an educated consumer is a healthy consumer.
So anyway, one of the secrets is the agave sweetener. Where do the tomatoes come from?
Tomatoes come from California.
Okay. And are they, I mean, they're naturally ripened? I mean, they're not these,
yeah.
They're not these horrible things that unfortunately we're used to eating at this time of the year?
No, that's one of the things that people really notice about the ketchup is what a great tomato flavor that we've gotten. We start with great tomatoes that the agave then mixes with to provide that sweetness that people are really looking for in their ketchup, and that background really allows for the spices to come forward.
Okay, now it's not a secret. You can buy the product, I think, at Whole Foods. Am I correct?
We are in the Whole Foods in the Northeast region, and
great.
We've just been approved, I've been told by my broker, in Southern California Whole Foods.
Oh, that's good. That's a good territory.
So, yeah, it's exciting. These things take a lot longer than I imagined, not having been in this business before. But we've
created
a lot of
interest. Well, didn't you grow up in your parents' restaurant? Where was it again, the restaurant?
Their restaurant was in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so. it was a great experience for me
to
work.
So you know the Clintons?
I've seen him a bunch.
Uh-huh.
Bet Bill likes it.
Hasn't tried it yet.
He hasn't tried
it.
You're sure now?
I am sure.
Okay.
Just to identify this, the website is Now, Whole Motto is spelled WHOLEMATO.com. And you will have a locator for stores on there?
Correct. If people enter in their zip code, you can find stores within the area. The other current option for people that may not have a store nearby is to go to the glutenfreemall.com or tropicaltraditions.com. Those are both online providers.
And this is beneficial not only to diabetics, but also to hyperactive children.
That's right.
We seem to have a lot more of those these days, too.
Yeah. The number of moms that have thanked me at demos is beyond count right now. To find a ketchup that is so important for so many kids and one that is hyperactivity friendly is a great bonus.
Well, this is a wonderful thing. We were really worried about the future when Heinz started bringing out ketchup that was green.
Green ketchup.
Something about this seemed wrong. The whole concept of a product where they've configured the bottle so that even though the ketchup's fairly thin, it still won't come out.
So you've got
a no flowing bottle trying to convince you that means it's richer, but probably all it really means is it's sweeter. And it has more things in it that aren't organic. So let's assume that the first ingredient you select for your fast food choice is ketchup. What do you put with it then? What's the accompaniment that you prefer? Do you put it on hot dogs? Do you put it on sausages? Do you
Personally,
put it on chicken?
Personally, I am a vegan at this point in my life.
I'd be very surprised if you came from a wellness center and ate hot dogs.
Although I have to admit, I ate a lot of hot dogs as a kid, and I loved them.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it goes with ketchup goes with tofu.
It goes great with veggie burgers.
Okay,
I've made an incredible tempeh chili. This is one of my mama's recipes. One of those quick ones you can do by substituting some of the tomato sauce with our ketchup, just because there's so many spices and great flavor in it.
Do you happen to know, by the way, we're contemplating interviewing someone who wrote a book called How to Pick a Peach?
No.
And it's all about sustainability and what you're eating and so forth. But the product that has the most major genetic modification and messing around with is, guess what?
Corn. Not ketchup.
Soybeans.
Soybeans.
So your tofu is hiding all kinds of really scary stuff. I've always hated tofu, so I'm kind of delighted.
So there you go.
That.
Maybe eating meat and fish isn't such a bad idea after all.
I don't know.
at least you know a little bit more about where they've been.
Well, yeah, after I finish Michael Pollan's latest book, I mean, I'll know more about what I can eat.
Sure.
In Defense of Food, it's called, so we'll see.
When I went to nutrition school, both my mom and I went to nutrition school. One of the major takeaways from the Institute for Integrative Nutrition is that everybody's body is different and everybody's body's needs change over time. So that I think the most important aspect of eating is to be really aware of what your body's asking for and not sticking to any hard and fast rules.
Right. I used to eat lobster shells until I got really sick on them.
And there
I think
you
that
go.
Was an iodine deficiency. Well, anyhow, this is getting way off base, and I know you're busy developing new products here. Jason, once again, everybody who wants to have a really fine and healthful ketchup should check out Whole Motto, WHOLEMATO .com.
And Dan Quayle would undoubtedly put an E on the end, but there isn't one there. it's not about toes, it's about Toms.
Yeah, and that, I think that's going to just about wrap up this week's program.
We've extracted about all the humor that we can out of ketchup.
Oh, you're such a good sport, Jason.
Jason,
thank you for talking to us.
Please get in touch with us when the new products are coming out, and this wonderful cliffhanger, this secret that you won't even tell us about.
Yes, hopefully, must stay tuned.
Hopefully you'll be able to tell us about it by the time the Fancy Food Show in New York in July. So
we'll try.
Okay.
And we'll see you then, and if not, we'll hear from you after that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both.
Okay, and then for this week, that's the end of the show.
We've had too much fun already, and it's time to quit.
And we're going to say bye-bye.
Same time, same place next week, listeners, and thank you so much for tuning in.